This belt is small, the right size for you.
Yuck, I said. It must feel something awful.
Well, not really, Miss Emily said. Once you get used to it, you won't even know it's there.
Well, I don't believe you, I said, making a face. That thin rubbing between your legs, poking out like a diaper, I don't think I'll ever get used to it.
Oh, yes you will, she said, extending her arm. Before you start feeling too sorry for yourself, just imagine being me. You'd need a suitcase to carry my pad in. Here, take it, she demanded, shaking her hand.
Just as I positioned my hand beneath the belt straps, Patani stomped through the kitchen door and got a glimpse of the pad dangling like a poor woman's pocketbook.
Dang, he grunted, did an about-face, and marched out. At once, Miss Emily began to giggle. Clamping my hands over my mouth, I laughed with her, the Kotex dangling below my chin. Land sakes, Miss Emily said, shaking all over, locking her fleshy, puffy hands together. From now on, we need to have our private conversations upstairs in your bedroom.
If we don't, I said, snickering, Patani might get the wrong idea and take to using this Kotex like a spittoon.
Lordy, we wouldn't want that, Miss Emily went on. I can already hear the good people of ginseng. Virgil Bedloe's been acting queerly of late. Quit that cutting up, Patani hollered from the living room, our guffaws booming, our bodies quaking so much that the table joggled against the floor. Or else you'll bring the whole house down.
With red cheeks, Miss Emily quickly composed herself. Breathing in deeply, crossing her arms over her chest, she waited until her skin was light pink again. Then, using the table for support, she heaved up from her chair.
Those aren't much fun either, she said, making a straight face, pointing at the other books on the table. Next month, though, I'll bring you some fun books. Vacation reading.
Finally, I said, clapping my hands.
Remember, she said, waddling toward the door, the floorboards creaking beneath her. 20 questions.
I made a move to get up, but was mesmerized by her huge bulk blocking the doorway.
Just imagine being me, she had said, and at that moment, I did.
There I was with a gigantic garter belt around my waist, a Kotex the size of a pillow squashed between my thighs.
No, don't bother, she said. I can make it by myself.
On Saturday, I decided to return to Clyda Stewart's place. I wanted to find those pasture roses and bring Patani an armful of them, not only for the kitchen table, but also for the living room. On the way, I lingered in the same spot where I had run into Peavy Lawson. There, beneath a cliff covered with goat's beard, I daydreamed about his tight, sinewy body and his crooked, impish smile. When I recalled the smell of him, a mixture of hay and licorice, I groaned and longed for him to be near me. My love, I whispered, my own true love. Tightly, I wrapped my arms around me. Thank you for the hug, I said, imagining Peavy's strong arms holding me close. I trailed my fingertips down my cheeks and pretended that Peavy was caressing my skin. Then, remembering his sweet and sensitive mouth, I puckered my lips and gently kissed the air. Over and over, I pretended to kiss him. In my mind's eye, Peavy and I were ardent lovers, our bodies aching with each kiss. Yes, yes. I whispered longingly, and with my body tingling all over, I slowly began to sing. Down in the valley so low. Again, I started down the pathway, my eyes following my feet. Hang your head over, hear the winds blow. For the first time in a long while, I took pleasure in the sweetness of my voice. The tension inside me began to dissolve as my lips stretched open, and my tongue tingled with relief as my voice massaged the muscles in my mouth and throat. If you don't love me, love whom you please, I sang on, the notes caressing me. Throw your arms round me, give my heart ease. My singing sounded tender, lilting from my lips like two doves cooing. Throw your arms round me before it's too late, I trilled, so proud of my voice, as sonorous as an echo in a cave, as hypnotic as a mermaid's chant. Throw your arms round me, feel my heart break, I crooned. Down in the valley, the mockingbird wings, telling my story, here's what he sings. Roses love sunshine, violets love dew, angels in heaven know I love you. Know I love you, dear, know I love you. Angels in heaven know I love you. My voice trailed off delicately like a sigh. My ears trembled with delight. A sense of calmness spread through my body. Instinctively, I stopped and looked up. A sea of pink floated in front of me. Oh, my, I squealed, recognizing the roses, racing toward them. Oh, my, I said, breaking off stems, clouds of pink rising above my hands. Excitedly, I gathered two fistfuls of blossoms. Satisfied, I glanced up, only to see in the distance, half a mile away, Clyda Stewart's old homestead. The gray, hand-hewn logs, silver-colored like the undersides of bluegills in Sweetwater Lake, glowed in the sunlight. And in that instant, knowing exactly where I was, I smiled and promptly decided to take a shortcut, weave through Clyda Stewart's yard, around his thick hedges, between his tulip trees, and end up on the gravel dirt road that led to Icy Creek Farm. Approaching his place, I heard footsteps and loud clucking noises. From across the clearing, Clyda Stewart, with his tidy red mustache, was prancing toward me, carrying two red chickens upside down, one in each hand. Their wings flapped savagely. Sprigs of red fluff flew through the air.
"Yes, sir,"
he said at the top of his lungs, turning around and winking at a little yellow-haired boy who was sitting on the porch.
"Lincoln Newland's got him some handsome chickens."
Immediately, I ducked behind a chestnut tree. In an instant, he tied the chicken's legs to a wire strung between two tulip trees. The hens cackled hysterically.
"Ain't it funny what a red fox can do?"
he said, wiping his hands on his overalls, dipping his fingers into a pocket.
"And this here red fox is crafty."
Standing bandy-legged in front of me, he spoke grandly.
"Yes, sir, old crafty red fox killed one on the spot, spreading feathers, blood, and innards all over the ground. Then he went and snatched two more, the plumpest Rhode Island reds he had ever seen. And like the wind, he fled with those chickens squawking."
Holding his hand high above his head, Clyda Stewart marched toward the chickens, all the while saying,
"Chicken and dumplings on his table."
Then his arm swung out. A flash of silver glittered in the sunlight, and a knife instantly appeared. Its sharp blade sliced through feathers, spraying blood over his sun-parched skin.
"Two more dollars under his mattress,"
he laughed, winking at the boy again. Gasping, I crouched down. Fiercely clutching the roses against my brownish-red shirt, I saw blood trickling down my arms as the thorns ate into my skin. There I dangled as surely as those two Rhode Island reds. "Matani!" I yelled, racing through the front door, the bunch of roses smashed but still pretty, clasped in both hands. "Look what I brought you!" Matani came out of the kitchen.
"Heavens to Betsy,"
she exclaimed, clapping.
"There's enough for the kitchen and the parlor."
"I'll go put them in some water," I said, dashing by her, heading toward the sink. "Can I use the green vase?" I said, plunking the roses down on the counter, turning on the faucet, splashing water over my hands and arms. "The thorns got me," I said. "I'm bleeding." I searched the counter. "Where's the vase?" I asked.
"I'll get it,"
Matani said.
"It's in the china closet."
"The green vase is for the kitchen," I said, "and the clear crystal one for the living room." I snatched a drying towel from the rack above the counter and wiped both hands. The old refrigerator hummed, and I remembered the lemonade inside. "Do you want something cold to drink?" I asked.
"I just had me a glass,"
Matani said, coming toward me with a vase in each hand.
"A carpet of pink," she said, winking. "I told you so, didn't I?"
"Yes, ma'am," I answered, filling up each vase with water, then arranging the roses within. "I squashed a few," I said, touching a blossom with several missing petals.
"A body can't traipse that far without losing a few," she said. "Ain't nothing to fret about."
"It's hot and lonely out there," I said. like every living thing has gone and dug itself a hole to keep cool in, then jumped inside. I grabbed a glass from the draining board, flung open the refrigerator door, picked up the pitcher of lemonade, and poured. Hot and lonely out there, I repeated, down in the whole glass, and with it the truthful parts of me. Ain't nothing out there, I said, swallowing hard, my throat constricting. The whole time I didn't see a soul, not a living, breathing soul. I poured myself another glass, looked up at her honest face, and felt ashamed. She stared at me for a second, fingered her hair, reinserted the gold combs around her gray knot, and said,
It's too tiresome to chit-chat on such a hot day.
Way too tiresome, I said, blushing, clamping my lips together, stifling a tiny croak.
Apparently you did your reading, Miss Emily said. Those were good questions.
Thank you, I said from the bed, staring at her. She sat in Batani's brand new but rejected rocker, which he had decided to give to me.
I like the old one, he had complained. A rocker should have arms.
Even though her fanny was squashed, the rolls of fat rising like dough against the rocker's back, she was smiling. And while the chair moaned beneath her weight, it nonetheless held her up.
So,
she said, pressing her palms together beneath her chin.
Do you have any more questions for me?
Well, I don't rightly think so, I said, shifting my weight on the edge of the bed. Those 20 about cover it. Squinting at me, she pursed her lips and asked,
What about questions that don't come from the books?
Well, what about them? I asked, kicking out my right leg, pointing my toes.
Do you have any? She asked.
Not exactly, I said, lowering my leg, kicking out my left. Her eyes began to twinkle, and she said,
Not exactly.
Implies that you might have a question or two. Well, I hesitated. Well,
Icy gal, spit it out. I can't stand all this hemming and hawing.
Well, I coughed, cleared my throat, glanced up at her and said, What if a person was to meet a feller?
A person meets fellers all the time, she replied. What about it?
Well, what if, when a person meets a feller, she thinks he's sort of cute.
So, she said, raising her eyebrows, aren't there cute boys in this world?
But what if he's the cutest thing she ever did see?
No harm in looking, she said.
I felt a knot in my throat. What if, I said, thumping my chest, what if she'd like to do more than look?
Just what do you mean by that?
Miss Emily asked, her sky-blue eyes opening wide. Well, what if she'd like to be touched? Beads of perspiration were slithering down the sides of my face. An odd expression crept across Miss Emily's face.
Are you saying what I think you're saying?
She asked, fanning her cheeks with her hands. Yes, ma'am, I said. Then, alarmed by her look, I thought better about it and rushed in to say, But I'm not talking about me. No, ma'am. I don't want some old boy sticking his wiggly up my vagina. That's how you have babies.
Icy Sparks,
she said, putting her hands on her knees, squeezing tightly.
We haven't talked about any of this. I was saving it for later. Where on earth did you hear this stuff?
I didn't hear it, I said. I read it.
But where? She asked in a high-pitched voice.
Well, in that book you gave me, I answered.
Which one?
She asked, pulling a handkerchief from her dress pocket and wiping her forehead.
I looked them over carefully.
From girl to woman, I said.
Not in the table of contents, she said.
In chapter 7, I said.
Give it to me, she ordered, sticking out her hand.
I grabbed the book from off the bed and handed it to her. With trembling hands, she turned to chapter 7 and began to read. As she turned the pages, her face became light pink, rose pink, then deep red.
Just as well, she remarked,
skimming the last page in the chapter and slamming the book shut.
I had planned this conversation for next year, but seeing as how you've brought up the subject, perhaps we should broach it now.
If you want to, I said, but I wasn't talking about myself. No, ma'am, tallywhackers are ugly. I mean, pee-pee comes out of that thing. Nasty yellow pee-pee. I contorted my face and shook my head. Good night, I said.
Then who were you talking about?
She asked, wrinkling the corners of her eyes. About...
For the life of me, I couldn't produce a name. About
Emma Richards, I blurted. I ran into her a few days ago.
Where? Miss Emily asked, pursing her lips.
At Lute's Grocery, that's where, I said. I was getting one of those bologna sandwiches, you know, with yellow cheese and mustard, and I saw her there. She was visiting her granny on Mill Creek Road.
And so, out of the blue, you and Emma Richards just started talking about boys. And in the middle of that delightful conversation, she decided to confess her most secret desires to you.
Uh-huh, I said, nodding.
Isagal, you'll be the death of me.
With those words, Miss Emily pushed herself up and red-faced began to lecture me.
First of all, she said, do you take me for a fool?
She inhaled deeply and pressed her fleshy hand against her heart. I shook my head. Apprehension gnawed at my stomach.
If memory serves me, she continued in a lawyerly tone, Emma Richards hates you. If Emma Richards hates you, why on God's green earth would she tell you her secrets? And second,
stretching out her right arm, slabs of fat quivering like jello, she pointed at me.
You don't go to Lute's Grocery because you're afraid. Afraid that you might have one of your spells.
She anchored her hands on her hips and glared. In her red, white, and blue striped dress, she was the American flag hanging outside the Crockett County Courthouse, standing for truth, intimidating me. But merciful God, her face was no longer beet red, her hand no longer massaged her chest. At once my stomach unclenched itself.
Okay, I confessed, relieved. I was talking about me and Peavy Lawson. I met him on the pathway to Clyde Stewart's farm the other day, and he was cute, not ugly like he once was. And he said nice things to me. He thinks I'm beautiful, the prettiest girl in Crockett County. And I got these tingling feelings all over me, like nothing I've ever felt before. And I just wanted him to touch me. Gentle like on the forehead. Honest to God, I didn't want his wiggling near me. I just wanted to be touched.
Exhausted, I slumped down, my head hung forward, my chin brushed my chest.
It's okay, Icy Gal, she said, the floorboard sighing as she walked toward me. Everyone wants to be touched. Sometimes even I want to be touched.
A high, nervous giggle escaped from her lips.
But who would want to touch me, right?
Well, someone would, I said, looking up. Someone, somewhere in these mountains.
No, Icy Gal, she said. You must accept the fact that touch isn't possible for people like us. We might be liked. We might even earn a town's respect. But we are different, too different. We exist beyond the comfort of touch. For us, Icy Gal, touching is dreaming, mere fantasy.
Well, I could feel my cheeks flaming, and despite my efforts, tears began to burn my eyes. Nevertheless, I refused to cry. Instead, I stood up. With the promise of hope riding squarely on my shoulders, I threw them back and faced her.
Maybe for you, I said, but not for me. Someone will touch me. If not Peavy Lawson, someone else then. But mark my words, Miss Emily Tanner, I will be touched.
She stood there, not speaking. She simply stood there on her tree trunk legs, staring wistfully through me, thinking about God knows what. A faint smile passed over her lips. Her eyelids closed. Her hands rose upward. Then, tenderly and ever so slowly, her fingertips began stroking her face. And, like a blind person, she touched herself until every inch of that round, fat face had been caressed. I had combed back my hair and fastened each side with one of Mitanni's combs, put on the deep purple dress with its purple and white striped apron and short puffy sleeves which Miss Emily had bought me. Then, because I wanted skin as pale as Snow White's to match my Snow White dress, I had sprinkled some of Mitanni's talcum powder on my cheeks. I had even eaten a cherry popsicle, sucking on it, pressing it against my lips, hoping for a smidgen of color. Upon arriving at our spot along the pathway, I was even more self-conscious. Any minute he would join me, see me, and judge me. I spotted a boulder protruding from the rock face, just big enough for me to sit on. The boulder, which was 2 feet high on one end and sloped down to 1 foot on the other, was ideal.
I transformed myself into a lounging Cleopatra, resting on my side, bending my arm, cradling my chin in my hand. For 5 minutes, I maintained this position until every muscle in my body started to knot up and quiver. I was shaking and rustling around on top of that rock when all at once, like magic, he materialized in front of me. "Pavy!" I yelped, rattling like an old woman with palsy, then slid down and plopped into the dirt, my hand still beneath my chin. Astounded, he stared at me, not speaking for what seemed forever. Then, in an instant, like a toy being wound up, with his shoulders thrown back and his head held high, he strutted forward, extended his calloused hand, and said, "Ma'am, are you in need of some help?" Thereupon, my head fell forward, jouncing up and down before halting, and my limbs stopped trembling long enough for me to stretch out my hand, grab his, and stand up on wobbly legs. "You came just in time," I said demurely. "I've been sickly of late. The sun was getting to me."
"Hot spells," he said seriously, like someone possessing full knowledge of such matters.
"Well, I wouldn't think so," I said quickly, my mind focusing on hot flashes, a condition discussed in Menopause and You, the last chapter from Girl to Woman. "I mean, I've just started."
"Just started what?"
he said, a puzzled expression on his face. I flushed crimson before I found the right words.
"Just started having hot spells," I corrected. "Before, when I was young, the heat never bothered me, but these days it does."
"'Cause now you're a young woman," he said, winking. "A beautiful young woman." Daintily, I took hold of my dress.
"Do you really think so?"
I asked, twirling around, facing him again. He nodded slowly and smiled.
"You were the girl for me."
He reached out and caught my hand.
"You still are."
My hand, seemingly not my own, hung limply in his. Nervous sweat seeped from my palm.
"You think so?" My voice quivered, and my breath came in shallow spurts.
"Cross my heart and hope to die," he said, squeezing my fingers. "That is, if you'll have me."
Speechless, I inclined my head.
Tenderly, he caressed my skin.
"Once you wouldn't talk to me," he continued.
"Once, you wouldn't give me the time of day."
"But that's all changed," I whispered.
"Once, you called me froggy."
"I was awful," I said, shaking my head.
"You told me to jump back into that pond where I belonged."
His voice cracked, and his eyes filmed over. "I acted a fool," I said. "I acted like a sore-tailed cat."
"Then I'm not a frog?" he asked, moving his head from side to side.
"Oh, no," I said vehemently. "You could never be a frog."
I put my free hand on top of his, the one that was holding mine.
"Even if you tried, you could never be a frog."
"Never," he said, looking deep into my eyes.
"Never,"
I replied. And then, before I knew it, I was lifting up on my tiptoes and craning my neck forward.
"Never," I said again. "'Cause today,"
my heart thumped ferociously against my chest.
"'Cause today, you are my prince."
I puckered my lips and kissed him squarely on the mouth. At that moment, he rocked backward. Our arms dropped to our sides, and we both stood silently, gazing into each other's eyes. In the depths of his pure green eyes, I was certain that I saw my future. Peavy Lawson and I were holding hands. Our lips were pressed together. Our bodies were touching.
"I'm in love," I said dreamily as I walked home. "I'm in love, I'm in love."
So this was how it felt to be a woman, feeling jiggly and soft inside like Mitanni's rice pudding, feeling love spread through your body and into your muscles, blood, and cells, feeling that the world would last forever and that your love would outlast the world.
"I'm in love," I said again. "I'm in love with Peavy Lawson. My own true prince."
All the way home, my mind replayed every minute of our rendezvous. I saw him worshiping me and admiring my beauty in my snow-white dress. I envisioned his hand stroking mine. I recalled his lips, tasting the softness of my kiss. Already, I had dismissed my slide off the rock into the dirt below and erased my mistaken notion that he had been talking about menopause. Anything unpleasant was deleted from my memory. Everything else was nurtured. I dwelled on his romantic words, the way his voice trembled when he declared his love for me. You were the girl for me. You still are. Cross my heart and hope to die, he had said. Yes, without a doubt, his love was rare. He had forgiven the harsh girl of his youth and loved the woman who now stood before him. When I strolled up, Pitani, rocking on the front porch, asked,
Girl, what's wrong with you?
Nothing, I said, tiptoeing up the steps.
Since when you been scouting around in that kind of getup?
Since I turned 13, I snapped. Since I became a woman.
Come over here.
He poked out his long arm and waved me over.
Stand still.
He rocked forward. Then, with his large boned hands, he took hold of my face and studied me. After several minutes, he concluded,
You look addled. How come?
I ain't addled, I said, pulling away from him, shaking him off like a dog shaking off water. Some people might call me beautiful, but not you. Oh, no, not you, because you're too busy calling me names. He repeated,
You look addled.
I ain't addled, I spat out, grinding my teeth together. I ain't the least bit addled. I stomped my foot. This woman standing before you ain't suffering from a dizzy brain. Angrily, I flicked my head from side to side. Absolutely not. This woman standing before you is hurting from the best of maladies. She's suffering from a melted heart. My grandfather stood up.
A melted heart,
he said, putting his hand on his chest. Yes, sir, I answered. A melted heart.
Well now, he said, rubbing his chin with his fingers. A melted heart is something special.
Yes, sir, I know, I murmured. For a week now, I've been trying to tell you. Pitani turned toward the door, cupped his hands around his mouth, and screamed,
Tilly, get on out here. Icy's got something to tell you.
In that instant, I regretted having uttered a word. Filled with dread, I sucked in my stomach and bit my lip.
What's the fuss?
Pitani said, quickly stepping through the door, wiping her hands on her apron. I was busy with supper.
Asa here has good news for you, he said, nodding at me.
What is it, child? Mitanni said. Like hot lead, embarrassment burned in my throat, making it hard for me to speak.
Dang, Asa, go on and tell her, Mitanni
ordered. I gagged, and several sentences wrenched through my lips.
I can't understand a word, Mitanni
said, glaring at my grandfather. Mitanni cleared his throat.
What Icy here's trying to say, he intervened, is that she's gone and got herself a beau.
Mitanni threw up her hands like exclamation marks on either side of her head.
Land sakes, she giggled. Where around here did you find a beau?
On the path to Clyde Stewart's place, I volunteered. We ran into each other.
Well, who is he?
Mitanni asked, slipping over, putting her arm around me. Peavy Lawson? I said softly. The arm around me dropped.
Peavy Lawson, she exclaimed. Oh, Frog Eyes?
Not anymore, I said, whipping my head from side to side. He's changed.
Well, he'd be Maybelle and Randall's boy, my grandfather said.
My grandmother nodded, and a faraway look clouded her eyes.
See that?
My grandfather said, winking.
That means she's studying the Lawson family tree.
Tell me, Icy, my grandmother said, suddenly clear-eyed and eager. How come he's way over here?
Clear across the valley,
Pitani added. 'Cause old man Potter hired him, I explained, to help with his livestock and fields.
Well then,
Pitani said, his eyes gleaming.
That young man of yours is a hard worker,
Pitani said.
Randall's got a good tobacco base,
my grandfather said.
Maybelle's birthed at least 9 children, my grandmother said. I never heard an unkind word about any of them.
Decent, honest, hard-working folk,
Pitani said.
The salt of the earth,
Pitani said.
And the boy likes our Icy,
Pitani said, rolling his eyes.
'Cause she's a looker, he went on. And mind you, Icy Sparks, if that young man knows what's good for him, he better stick to looking.
Shush, my grandmother warned, wagging a finger at him. Peavy Lawson is our granddaughter's first fella. You will not tease her. Do you hear me?
Patani jutted out his jaw.
Wasn't I the one who called you out here? He pouted. Wasn't I the one who let loose the good news? Didn't I tell you everything with a big fat grin on my face?
I reckon you did, Virgil,
my grandmother said, stepping over to him, patting his stomach.
I reckon I married me a sweetheart.
Peavy Lawson is sweet, too.
I was enjoying my newfound status.
He's as sweet as molasses, I said, wanting to regain the spotlight.
But already it was too late. Patani was leaning over, way over, because he was so tall, and Patani was reaching up, high up on her toes, and both of them were kissing, giving each other tiny little pecks, like two birds grooming one another. None of it was romantic. Nothing like that tender kiss I placed on Peavy Lawson's lips. Their love's wonderful, I thought, watching my grandparents kiss each other. But it was nothing like Peavy and me. Nothing like our young love, our Romeo and Juliet love. My stomach rumbled uneasily.
Aren't we ever gonna eat around here? I don't want you to go back to school, I said, my voice cracking, my white cotton blouse sticking in the heat to my skin, my pink seersucker shorts chafing my thighs. I'm gonna be so lonely.
Well, I don't want to go neither, Peavy said, gently tugging at the bottom of my blouse, but I ain't old enough to drop out.
I tilted forward on the tips of my tennis shoes, already darkened by the dust, closed my eyes, and we kissed.
I'm afraid you might forget me, I said, opening my eyelids, the sun off the rock face blinding me.
There are other fish in the sea, I pouted. Leaning back on his heels, he widened his eyes and shook his head.
But I ain't going fishing, he said.
I'm talking about other girls, I said. You might meet somebody else, some girl at school, and like her more than me.
Peavy stomped his right foot.
Oh, no,
he said as dust rose and settled on his boot and the bottom of his blue jeans like gray talcum powder.
You're my woman. Ain't no cause for you to worry, he reassured me.
I done seen y'all summer, every Thursday for weeks, 9 sweet times. And once summer comes round, I'll be right back here helping old man Potter spending time with you.
Well, what about all the months in between? I asked, my mouth trembling. What'll I do?
I bit at my lip and screwed up my eyes and nose. Sorrow lined my brow. The desolation of the trail was depressing me, reminding me of the loneliness to come. The grass had turned yeller and parched. Many of the wildflowers had withered. By August, the goat's beard that had once been so plentiful had long since dried up and disappeared. Only alum root, its blossoms sprouting like thin beards, dotted the ridges.
It ain't so long, Peavy said, stepping forward, trailing his pinky along my forehead. Maybe I can come see you in the spring, after the snow has melted, when the weather's good.
You think? I asked, barely smiling.
Why not? He replied.
And will you write me? I asked.
Only if you write me,
he said, tapping his chest, leaving behind little dots of sweat on his green shirt. Then he held out his arms. The minute he folded his arms around me, pressing me against him, my anxiety evaporated. Like a shot of Patani's whiskey, his presence calmed me. With him, I was free of the urges and compulsions, of the disorder that had plagued me for so long. I want to bottle him, I thought, as he held me close. I want to sprinkle Eau de Peavy all over my body. In the spirit of Elizabeth Barrett Browning, I wrote Peavy love poems and letters. You are my knight in shining armor, I wrote. My own Sir Lancelot, riding off to school, battling to defend my honor. Tucked between the pages, I slipped in one of Mitanni's late-blooming white roses. White stands for purity, pure like our love for each other, I went on. Peavy, my brave knight, pin this rose to your undershirt beneath your cold armor. It will keep you warm and safe. Smiling, I signed the letter. From Icy, your own golden-haired Guinevere. Peavy answered. Roses are white, violets are blue, you are icy sparks, and I love you. Oh, my love is like a red, red rose, I replied, quoting Robert Burns. Roses are red, violets are blue, he wrote back. My name is Peavy Lawson, and I love you. In a book of Victorian poetry, which Miss Emily had given me, I discovered a poem, Tristram and Iseult, by Matthew Arnold, about the tragic love affair between Tristram, one of the most famous knights of the Round Table, and Iseult, wife of King Mark. Filled with longing, I imagined myself as Iseult, separated from my own true love. Blame me not, poor sufferer, that I tarried, I copied carefully. Bound I was, I could not break the band. Chide not with the past, but feel the present. I am here, we meet, I hold thy hand. I ended the letter with, your loving Iseult. Below the signature, I drew a cracked heart. Peavy replied, roses are red, violets are blue. What are you talking about? It don't matter, 'cause I still love you. P.S. Is your middle name Insult? Twice a week we wrote to each other. When a letter of his arrived, I'd tenderly carry it to my room, hold the envelope up to the sunlight, and marvel at the curve of his Y in icy, at the sensual sweep of his S in sparks. For Christmas, I send him a present. Christmas isn't merry, I wrote, because you're not here with me. But I made you something anyway. It's an ornament for your tree, a papier-mâché heart. The yellow crack down the center stands for my own heart. It's breaking for you. Do you like it? I put my name on one side and yours on the other. Two halves make a whole, sweetheart. Two halves of our heart beat as one. Hang this ornament from your tree, my brave knight, and when you look at it, be sure to remember me. The heart's real pretty, he replied. I hung it near the top of our tree. Ain't nobody but me knows it's there. Do you like what I sent you? Uncle Ed took it last summer when we went to the hog show at the Crockett County Fair. That smile on my lips is there 'cause when he snapped it, I was thinking of you. Happy New Year, my dearest, sweetest, handsomest Peavy, I jotted down on New Year's Eve. Soon we will be seeing each other again. Soon spring will be here. Then, with the help of Emily Dickinson, I giddily added the following verse. If you were coming in the fall, I'd brush the summer by, with half a smile and half a spurn, as housewives do, a fly. I'm always thinking of you, too. Peavy responded immediately. I see, he scribbled. I thought we were going to see each other in the spring, the Saturday before Easter. Sorry about your fly problem. Tell your grandpa to check under the house for puddles. I answered him, at the same place, at the same time. The snow is melting, he replied. Soon the red buds will be blooming. That's how soon I'll see you. We spotted each other at the same time. As soon as I caught sight of him in his brown suit and yellow tie, my heart heaved and my head seemed to float above my body. Peavy, I yelled, racing toward him in my new yellow cotton dress, with my arms flapping, my yellow handbag dangling from my forearm. I see, he screamed back, running toward me, stumbling once but not falling in his glossy brown shoes. Simultaneously, we threw our arms around each other, pressing chest to chest. My pocketbook, slipping, hung weakly from my wrist. The tips of my shoes lapped over the tips of his. One of my barrettes, covered with yellow vial flowers, had slipped from the side of my upswept bun, and several strands of hair now hung loosely around my neck. My breath was wet and hot against his shirt. His shirt was stiff from too much starch. I leaned back and gazed at his face. His hair was slicked back, smooth and oily. The freckles across his nose had faded. Two blemishes stood out on his chin. I inhaled a powerful cologne. Oh, Peavy, I gushed, letting my arms drop to my sides. You've bottled yourself for me. He smiled broadly. A diamond of saliva plopped from his top lip onto the ground. His eyes, befuddled, clouded over. Oh, Peavy, I just love your cologne, I added. You do? He said. It's called Brute. It's my brother's. Are you a brute? I asked teasingly. My eyes toyed with him. My mouth watered slightly. Tenderly, he touched his chest. What do you think? He asked. From his front shirt pocket, he pulled out a rose, the white rose which so many months ago I had sent him. Peavy! Once more, I wrapped my arms around him and urgently kissed his lips. I see, he said, kissing me back. I could feel his teeth scraping against mine and his body vibrating. Now, he urged. Now what? My skin tingled all over. Let me hold you. His voice was high and shrill. But you are holding me. My mouth was cupped against his cheek. My lips felt drunk and heavy. I want to hold you close, he said breathlessly. Behind those pines over there. He freed an arm and pointed to the spot where he had hidden that first time we met. My limbs felt weak. If you want to. My voice was tremulous. Tightly, he gripped my hand and without talking, led the way. In a daze, I followed him. I would have done anything for this young man who carried my rose beneath his cold armor. The spring sun shone down, illuminating pennywort, inches high with its white funnel-shaped flowers, and star chickweed with its 5 deeply cut petals, growing in the distance along the wooded slopes. To me, the star chickweed blossoms were guiding lights, fallen from heaven, showing us the way. As we neared the little group of pine trees, Peavy pointed at a clearing 5 feet away and smiled. My Tristram, I said, suddenly overcome with emotion. Blame me not, poor sufferer, that I tarried. Bound I was, I could not break the band. Chide not with the past, but feel the present. I am here, we meet, I hold thy hand. With these words, I firmly squeezed his palm. Hand in hand, we walked to the clearing where he began cleaning away rocks and sticks. Thereupon, he ran back to the copse of pine trees, jerked off his coat, gathered up fallen pine needles, and tossed them on his jacket. Then, using his garment like a knapsack, he returned and scattered the pine needles all over the ground. Our bed, he said, his eyes as green as the new shoots popping up. Our bed, I said. Feelings of ecstasy mingled with those of fear. Taking both of my hands, he gently pulled me down. On our sides, several inches apart, we stared into each other's eyes. I see, his hand sneaked toward me. I see, his fingers tugged at one of the pockets on my dress. Peavy, I stammered, leaning toward him. I see, he repeated in a quivering voice. Peavy, I whispered, and felt his fingers slide down my neck. I see, he said, stroking my Peter Pan collar. My tiny breasts ached. Peavy, I moaned. His green eyes twitched and popped out of his head. Oh, I see, he cried. Alarmed, I glanced down. His hand was on my bodice, cupping my breast. And although I liked his touch, it also terrified me, so much that in that instant, I envisioned my real future. Peavy Lawson's wiggly inside me, spewing forth pee-pee and sperm, babies leaping from my stomach, yowling and crying, a brown weathered shack clinging to the side of a mountain, and the bitter stink of coal fouling the air. I saw all of my hopes and dreams lying dead, lined up side by side, in the happenstance of one touch. Peavy, I stammered, feeling a croak building up in my throat and a jerk collecting in my muscles. Oh, I see, passionately he squeezed my breast. It feels so good. Fiercely, I clenched my teeth and forced my lips together. I see, oh, I see, he said, his eyes popping from his head. The croak shoved against my mouth. My eyes flew out. Blinking and breathing heavily, he clutched my breast. My sweet Icy, he groaned. At that moment, for the first time in a long time, I saw his froggy green eyes gazing at me and felt his muscle-hopping body pressing against mine. Disgusted, I stared at his amphibian, dead-white skin and at his thin-lipped, fly-catching mouth, and I panicked. A convulsion of sheer terror shook me, and my whole body, arms, legs, neck, and torso, began to jerk. I see, Peavy said, arching away from me. I see, he said loudly. Croak, I roared. I see, he said, jerking back. Croak, my body whipped to the left. What the heck, he said, leaping up. Croak, croak, my limbs surged to the right. By damn, he said, looking down at me.
Then, staring a hole right through me, his eyes bulging, his lips grinning, he guffawed like a thousand frogs disrupting the night. "You do beat all," he yelled, slapping his thighs. "Croak!" I bellowed, jumping upward, landing solidly on the ground. I shot out my right leg and twirled around on my left. "Croak!" I screamed, turning around and around. "Croak!"
"You're crazy," he said, laughing nervously.
"Nutcase," he added, scrambling backward. On a dime, I stopped spinning.
"A loony person," he snickered, pointing at me. "Just like everybody says."
In that instant, I breathed in deeply, gulped down all of my anger, and spewed it back out.
"You frog-eyed piece of slime," I snarled. "Why don't you jump back into that pond where you belong?"
There we stood, face to face. Out popped his eyes.
"Monster," he growled.
"Frog eyes," I cried.
"I don't need this,"
he smacked his hands together.
"You need a pond to swim in. You need some lily pads to hop on."
"I need me a normal gal," he said angrily. "A gal people like. Someone like Emma Richards."
"Well, you can have her," I shouted, my voice shaking. "Just get out of here."
"Don't mind if I do," he said, plucking his coat off the ground. "You've made your blister."
He clicked around on his heels and began to walk away.
"Now sit on it."
For weeks, I refused to discuss with my grandparents what had happened with Peavy Lawson. How could I tell them that Peavy and I had been kissing? How could I tell them that we had lain on the ground, side by side, and that I had let him touch my dress where my breast was? I couldn't. I just couldn't. So I didn't tell them anything. Whenever either asked about him, I'd shrug and say, "We broke up." I walked around the house with a perpetual scowl on my face, with my shoulders humped over as though I were a shriveled-up old spinster. Upstairs in my lonely bed, the bitterness of Miss Emily's life, forever living without another's touch, overwhelmed me. And because of Miss Emily's moon face, I saw my own, the empty landscape of limbless, faceless people. My heart tore away from the rest of my body, and like the uprooted stump of a tree, it floated inside me, disconnected from my soul. Lonely, desolate, my heart pumped only for itself and let me be. "Oh, Lord," I cried, staring at the vacant ceiling. "God help me." And closing my eyes, tenderly and ever so slowly, I began to stroke my face. "There ain't no reason to celebrate my birthday," I pouted, sitting on Matani's new oval-shaped braided rug, the corners of my mouth pulled down like someone suffering the aftermath of a stroke. Miss Emily frowned back. "There is no reason to celebrate my birthday," she corrected me.
"Whichever way you say it," I said, "it means the same."
Matani tipped forward in his frayed easy chair and shot me a look. Grinning, Matani turned and nodded at Miss Emily, who was sitting beside her on the sofa. Miss Emily nodded back, positioned her square hands on either side of her body, and huffing, tried to hoist herself up.
"Aussie gal,"
she began, falling back onto the sofa, the cushions whooshing with her weight.
"Give me your hand."
I crooked my head to one side.
"Why?"
I asked.
"Shush,"
Miss Emily pressed her fat index finger against her lips.
"Your hand, please."
Cautiously, I thrust out my arm, slowly turned over my hand, and exposed the pink flesh of my palm. Looking around, I noticed that all three of them were leaning forward expectantly, smiles as wide as watermelon slices cut into their faces.
"What are you all up to?" I asked.
Dramatically, Miss Emily slipped a piece of paper between Matani's fingers.
"Just this," she said. "Just this,"
my grandmother repeated, and reaching over, she flamboyantly placed the slip of paper in my palm. I stared at the cream-colored paper, no bigger than a 3x5 index card, the top of which read, "Crockett County Telephone Cooperative," typed in bold print. Then in a neat cursive hand below it was the message, "Dear new customer, we will be installing your telephone during the week of June 7th through the 12th. Thank you for your order."
"A telephone?" I asked, anxiously glancing at Patani.
"Just for you," he said grandly. "'Cause you're a modern gal,"
Miss Emily said.
"A regular teenager,"
Matani added. In that instant,
my arm began to quiver, and like a maple leaf in the breeze, the piece of paper trembled in my palm. A regular teenager, I thought. A regular teenager, I said aloud. A regular teenager, I sneered, watching my hand shake, seeing the paper shimmy back and forth. Icy, Patani said, alarmed. Icy gal, Miss Emily said. What's wrong? Matani asked, rising. Are you blind? I asked as the slip of paper quaked spasmodically. Can't any of you see? My hand lurched upward, and the paper fell to the floor below. Don't you understand? I cried, restraining my arm with the other. Who in this great big wide world is ever gonna call me? My grandfather was yelling, God damn it! God damn thieving fox! As I strolled up the dirt driveway. Veering to the left, I ran toward the barn. In the distance, through the dusk, I could see his large, bulky form, his left arm raised high above his head, a dead chicken grasped in his hand. God damn fox! He screamed, swinging the chicken back and forth. God damn fox! Waving my arms, I raced toward him. Patani, I yelled, what's wrong? Looking up, he caught sight of me. Then he lowered his head and dropped his arm. The chicken slipped from his fingers and plopped in a haze of dust on the ground. I see, he said, wilting in front of me. I didn't mean for you to hear that. I walked over and picked up the mangled, plump red hen who never failed to lay an egg every day. Poor Zelda, I said. Some thieving fox, he said wearily. Zelda, Henrietta, and Bonnie. Not Bonnie, I shook my head. She was so pretty. He wiped his forehead with the back of his hand. I had to lock the rest of them up, he said. They was carrying on so. Buster was stark raving mad. I'm sorry, Patani. I heard Buster still squawking loudly. I know how much you love them. The varmint carried off Bonnie and Henrietta, that stupid scrawny hen, but left Zelda all over the place. He looked around the yard. He didn't even have the courtesy to eat her, and her being the plumpest and the juiciest. He left the best one here. Left Zelda right here in the yard, almost like that fox was laughing, being spiteful, saying, wake up, old man, I can come back any old time and gobble me down a fat one. Scanning the ground, I spotted only a scattering of thin-lined strokes. Well, where's the tracks? I asked. I can't find nary a one, Patani said. Odd, ain't it? You sure you didn't stomp through 'em? I asked. I mean, you was upset. Patani shook his head. Nope. He was vehement. I watched myself and looked where I was stepping. I tell you, there weren't no tracks. Well, that's 'cause... I hesitated and breathed in. Well, that's 'cause... I stopped again. Speak up, child, Patani said, narrowing his eyes. Tell me what's on your mind. I walked over to the zigzag lines. Well, look at these here marks. Squatting down, I ran my index finger through the dirt. Well, looks like someone took a twig and made them. My grandfather joined me. Bending over, he said, Why, I declare, I hadn't noticed. Well, maybe this varmint walks upright, I said. Maybe what we got us is a two-legged varmint. Yes, buddy, Patani said. He cut himself a brushy twig, swished through his footprints, and left poor old Zelda behind. To throw you off, I said. Don't you know he did? Patani stood up. But who? A neighbor, I ventured. Oh, no, Patani said. Why not? I asked. 'Cause no neighbor of mine would do something like that, he said. I stood up, placed my hands staunchly on my hips, and asked, How can you be so sure? No one knows what another person is up to. Everybody's got secrets. 'Cause I know my neighbors. Nary a one of them would rob me blind. Well, this time you're wrong, 'cause one of them already did. Patani scowled. Who then? Poor old Mamie Tillman? Someone you'd never guess. Spit it out, girl. Say who you mean. I pressed my fingernails into my hips. Clyde Stewart, that's who. He's the varmint stealing your chickens. Patani made a fist and smacked his palm. Icy sparks, he said, in a voice so full of rage that it cut through the air like wind wheezing around a taut, thin wire.
Why are you lying about my good friend's son?
I'm not lying, I said, my voice also swelling with anger. I'm telling the truth. If you're too deaf to hear it, then that's your doing, not mine.
Patani fisted his palm again and red-faced fumed.
Lately you've been spreading your misery around like jam on bread, but never, fiercely he shook his head, never in my wildest dreams would I have imagined you'd do this.
Do what? I growled back. Clean the wax out of your ears and make you hear the truth?
You got no right bad-mouthing neighbors. You got no right slandering a friend of mine.
Clytus Jr. ain't no friend of yours, I said. Your friend was Clytus Sr., and he's long since been dead and buried.
You better watch it, young lady. Just watch your tone with me.
I removed my hands from my hips, pointed angrily at him, and said, You best quit worrying about me and turn your energy to someone else, to that dear friend of yours who's about to cook your hands.
Why, you've lost your head, my grandfather shouted, spreading such stories.
My head's on straight as ever, I declared, thrusting out my chin.
Young lady,
my grandfather glowered at me.
I'm getting sick and tired of your nastiness. Darkness is the only thing you see.
My voice shook, but determined, I didn't cry.
I saw him with my very own eyes, I said. I was out walking and saw him, all high and mighty, tying two plump chickens from a wire stretched between two tulip trees. All the while, he bragged to that son of his how he had stolen two of Lincoln Newland's plumpest hens, how he had killed one on the spot and left the innards behind. All the time, he went on about himself, called himself a crafty old fox. Then he swung that knife of his and cut their throats. As sure as God is my witness, he sprayed the yard with blood. That's the truth.
Well, if you're so honest, why didn't you come right home and tell me?
Patani asked.
How come you've been so quiet?
If you want to believe a thief, that's your privilege and your right, I cried. If you think Clytus Jr. is so good and I'm so bad, so dagnab different, so be it. If you feel that way, I don't want to be your kin.
And with those words, I broke down and began to cry. Patani made a guttural sound, took one step toward me, snatched my hand and said,
Come on, we're gonna settle this thing, once and for all.
When Patani drove up to Clyde Stewart's place, it was still light. No vehicle was parked in the back, and the house seemed empty.
Well, I don't see anyone,
my grandfather said, slowly opening his door.
No people and no dead chickens.
They'd be in the front yard, I said, away from the road.
Open your door,
he ordered.
Let's go and see.
I wiped my nose with my palm, unlatched the door, pushed it ajar with my foot, and stumbled out. The tulip trees are in the front, I said, away from the road, overlooking the valley.
I hear you,
he said coldly, walking quickly toward the front yard, way ahead of me. When he rounded the corner, I heard him. Even before I saw him, I heard him. A sad, low groan, like the bellow of a sick cow, came to my ears, and I knew then that he had seen them, that he had seen Henrietta and Bonnie dangling from that wire, blood, like droplets of rain, scattered over the ground. Quietly, I came up behind him.
That's them, all right,
he said in a shaky voice. But I didn't say a word, just turned around and briskly walked back to the truck.
I've always been a yaller dog Democrat,
Patani said when he heard President Eisenhower speaking as we listened to the evening news on the radio in the parlor.
Old Ike helped us whoop the Germans, and I respect him for that, but he's still acting like a general, not a president, and all this time he ain't done nothing here at home. 8 years of doing nothing is 8 years too long.
As he spoke, he nervously tapped his large foot against the floor, all the while stealing looks at me, all the while turning into a stranger. I saw him changing, once grabbing his arm, shaking it like it had died on him. I heard him complaining of dizziness, of punishing headaches. He was laying low, not working as hard, getting thinner, but I couldn't make myself be kind to him. Some fierceness of pride had come over me. The more I wanted things to be like they were, the worse I behaved. The worse I behaved, the more I hated myself and the nastier I became. In my grandfather, I saw every person who had ever hurt me. He became Mrs. Eleanor Stilton, He was Peavy Lawson. He was every snicker I had ever heard in the million staring eyes that excluded me from the Flatland. He stood for judgment and intolerance, the Isles of townspeople parting. He was a red heart pumping normalcy. He was a Bedloe. I was a Sparks.
"If I don't like that vice president of his," Pitani went on, "why should I cast my vote for him? Anyhow, that young fella Kennedy did just fine when he was politicking in West Virginia. Even took it upon himself to go down deep into a mine shaft where he almost got himself killed on a high-voltage line. Story goes he talked to the miners like they was family, never putting on airs, never preaching at them, just asking them about their work."
"None of that excuses the fact that he's a Catholic," Mitanni added, "and I don't want some pope telling me what to do."
Surprised, I perked up.
"A Catholic," I declared, turning to look at my grandmother.
Mitanni bit her lip, nodded, and continued to crochet.
"He was baptized in the Catholic Church, just like you was in the Baptist," Pitani said, fixing his eyes on her. "That's all it means. Ain't no one taking orders from the Pope."
"Mercy me, I hope not," Mitanni shot back.
Pitani cleared his throat.